I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. Album is I'm Sorry, You're Welcome. The artist, Eugene Merman, and my guest this week is Spencer Sapienza. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for having me.
Please tell me I got your name right. I did pronounce it correct. Yay!
It was beautiful.
Thank you.
Like talking to my Nona back in Sicily.
Oh, you know, that's the first time I've ever been accused of sounding Sicilian, and I like it. I say accused, you understand. Told that I, you know, remind anybody of anyone Sicilian, and I'm very excited about it. No, Thank you.
I think in any other part of Italy, being called Sicilian is an accusation.
That, you know, I've heard this. It doesn't seem fair, but I have heard this. You picked a 7LP record. Now, you said this is the one thing you own on vinyl. Why do you own it?
Okay, well, yeah, I own a couple other comedy records. But this is probably the one I'm most personally invested in owning.
Fair.
In part because it prompts the question, why would you own it? Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had been a fan of Mr. Merman for many years. I got to see him live a couple times, which was always great. Mm-hmm. And then I remember sometime around his announcement of the album, I was like, oh, I need this obnoxious box, this beautiful, lovely, obnoxious box. And the box itself is actually beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I believe I got it as a Hanukkah present from an aunt that year, something like that. And I, you know, I think my family members are used to being like, Spencer wants this shit for whatever, you know, we'll order it from walmart.com for him, whatever this is, you know? So I was very excited to get it. And I believe I had seen the special on Netflix also that ties into it. Yeah. But I was so excited to listen to it. I listened to the whole thing that day. Mm-hmm. And I in my childhood bedroom in my parents' house. And people were coming in and out being like, what are you listening to?
Of course they were. Yeah.
Yeah. hours pouring over it. Yes, it was great. It was great.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to look because I feel like it's still got to be on sale because there's no way they sold out of this thing. There's no way, right?
I looked a couple weeks ago when we started talking about this. So when the album came out, other than the fact that it is a 7LP box set, which is already a big ask, he did deluxe editions of it where, you know where I'm going with this. Yes.
Yeah, please though.
He released it. He had an MP3 player preloaded with the album, sewn into bathrobes that you could buy the quote robe edition of the album, which I don't know how that works, but I think that's brilliant. That's, and then, I believe the robe is still on sale. You can still buy some of the robes, what is sold out is the chair edition.
Oh my God.
Which he made, I think he made two or three. He had like some artisanal carpenters, whatever, make chairs again with the album preloaded in an MP3 player inside the chair. And those went for like hundreds of dollars. And I can only imagine who has that in their home.
Yeah, I'd like very much to know who the commitment to the bit is strong. This is, okay, so let me see. What is it? I was trying to see here. Does it say how many? You can still buy the vinyl. Okay, so that's good. Mm-hmm. I won't, only because it's a $60. It is him intentionally wasting my time, and he knows what he's doing. That is the goal of this. Now, it was worth listening to as an MP3. Mm-hmm. I guess I could say thank you to the good people at Sub Pop for sending me that a while back and not sending me the vinyl, but whatever. Or the chair. I know they weren't going to send me a chair, but a robe would be nice. Mm-hmm. It's a massive, beautiful waste of time that he clearly... But I mean... It sounds entirely improvised, much of it. What, do you know anything about the creation of it, other than what it is?
Yeah. I was reading a little bit about it before, and it seems like he actually had been working on this on and off for years, which at once you're like, you know, it's 6 LPs or 7 LPs, whatever it is, and it's all, other than there's one of them is a stand-up hour, which is, you know, good. If you like Eugene Merman, it's a good stand-up hour. And then the rest of it is novelty. it's noises and it's imagined conversations and bullshit bits. And you know, I think it's great. I love it. But it, at once that undertaking, you're like, oh, this could be a massive magnum opus of a person's career. Or you're like, oh, this is like some stupid nonsense he tossed off in one day in a recording booth.
Yeah.
And I think it was kind of both of those things. I read an interview where he said he was trying to convince Sub Pop to let him release a 100-disc album at some point, which again, you know, that on the face of it, see, that is the joke almost.
Yeah.
And then I think in the course of that conversation, they were able to end up making this 7 LP thing a reality. And I think it was like, at once a lot of work and also him going into a recording booth with a couple. There are a couple other writers and people credited on the album or on the box, you know. So I guess it must have been some type of collaborative effort and it wasn't just him. But it seems like a lot of, you know, when he, there's a whole 45 minutes of him crying. And I have to imagine that that, you know, that doesn't require a huge amount of collaboration or forethought.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other than having the idea for it, which, you know, and I was, don't get me wrong, I was very happy to ask Aunt Jody to shell out $60 for this. Very happy.
That's a nice aunt. That is very, very kind of her. She, you know, to be fair, you did make me listen to, one of the things you had me listen to was the Russian translation. And there are several where he seems quite surprised by, like, I can't translate that one. Or he's like laughing too hard. So clearly he's got a stack of suggestions. And he's doing his best, whatever Russian he can remember, which is, good God.
Yeah. Yes.
It's really beautiful.
He does, he introduces the bit by saying, you know, oh, I think he was born in Russia. I could be wrong. So he is an immigrant. And, you know, he has that experience. And I think he, childhood, speaking it on and off and probably speaking it on and off in the home. But he clearly, he introduces the bit by saying, you know, my Russian's not good. Don't quote me on this. But then he's like, you know, 20 minutes of variations of your family smells like trash in childhood, half-remembered Russian. And I really enjoy... on the LP, sometimes at the end of a side, he will include what seems like outtakes also, which, I mean, yes, you have to pad the runtime of a 7 LP set,
sure you
I
do,
suppose.
Yeah.
but to hear him breaking, I think is actually a lot of fun, considering so much of this is him very close mic'd, good sound, saying absolute nonsense, or making crying noises, or, you know, making orgasm noises, or whatever, whichever... hilarious LP you've chosen to enjoy.
It's one of those things that where I can talk shit, and I talk shit out of love, of course, because I'm so jealous I didn't have the idea or the resources to make it happen. It's pure jealousy. This is the kind of thing I would love to make tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you are a person, you get a distribution deal, whatever record deal, whatever it is, you, Sub Pop comes to you and they say, hey, we want to put out vinyl of your act. You, we think you're really funny. I think that you would have a hard time selling somebody on a 7 LP box set of novelty noises if it's your, if you are up and coming. I think this is very much, this is the work of an established person who thinks, oh, I could probably sway a couple idiot kids in suburban New Jersey to get this as a Hanukkah gift, you know?
Yeah.
So
it is it is described as a 7-disc, 9-volume piece. So volume 1 is live in Seattle at the Columbia City Theater. Volume 2, a guided meditation for the thoughtful body. Volume 3, Fuckscape. Volume 4, Eugene's comprehensive sound effects library. Oh my God, it's so many tracks. Okay. Volume 5, Digital Drugs. Volume 6, over 45 minutes of crying. Volume 7, Introduction to Spoken Russian. Volume 8, Ringtones and Outgoing Voicemail Messages for Your Personal Use. And Volume 9, 195 Orgasms. That is, are they separated into individual tracks on the vinyl? This is what I'm interested in, or is it just one long track?
There is exhaustive liner notes within the box, but I was looking at the on the LPs themselves, I couldn't really notice like, you know, the grooves or whatever on like a normal album, you can see the delineations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think, you know, when you have 195 orgasms or whatever you're listening to, I don't know how pressing actually works.
Right.
But I don't know if at the factory they're saying we need 195 rings on this side. I don't know.
I now wonder if that's even physically possible. I will have to ask a couple people I know, but I'm guessing, yeah, it's just, no, let's just let it run.
Yeah.
See if we can even fit it on this record, because he seems to be pushing the limits. Where did you first discover Eugene Merman?
What's mildly interesting about that question is he's the first comedian I remember seeing on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
I remember a friend showing me videos of him speaking straight to camera in what seemed to be his apartment, you know, probably 12, 15 years ago, maybe a little more. I don't remember exactly. Whenever YouTube first started being a thing that people would just sort of like pass around links, I'd say sometime post Shoes, if you remember that horrible video, but pre Jake Paul, you know, whatever, in the Wild West of early YouTube. Yes, I remember seeing, and it was very much, it was clearly he was doing bits that he had been doing on stage. I can't remember anything in particular now, but first person I ever saw do anything like that, he was basically doing his act right to camera, which
that's funny.
Yeah.
That's very strange to me. I don't think I've ever seen anything. You know, I'm pretty sure is that true? I don't think I discovered him from Bob's Burgers. I must have seen some of his stand-up a bit before, but it doesn't go back as far as what you're describing. Have you rewatched any of these younger Eugene Merman videos since?
No, I should have. You know, and he's somebody who, you know, I've probably seen most of his hours. I always enjoy them. I do like Bob's Burgers.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't watched Home Movies, which I've only heard great things about.
Yeah.
And I haven't. Yeah, I haven't dug up those like, whatever 150p YouTube videos.
Right.
I probably should.
Mm-hmm.
I
was recently recommended something that I have purchased and not listened to yet. Have you heard Invite Them Up, which is from 2005, probably around roughly the time he was doing that. It was a three
No, I haven't. That was the name of his stage show, right, at the time?
Yeah, and it's, good God. So 2005, but it's Bobby Tisdale, Mike Birbiglia, Dimitri Martin, Eugene Merman, of course, names I don't know, John Glazer, let's skip the problematic people, David Wayne, Chelsea Peretti, there's only one or two, Todd Barry, 80 Miles, Andy Blitz, Jesus Christ, John Benjamin and David Cross. I mean, these are all Bob's Burgers names as well, but also a lot of people who would become quickly quite famous.
Yeah.
Worth listening to, I'm sure. I don't know why I recommended it, except that, you know, might be worth listening to since you like yourself some Eugene Merman. So, all right. So you discovered him through YouTube. Have you, I don't know. So you've seen him live.
Mm-hmm.
How did that feel in terms, like, what made you go see him live? Was he that funny? Was he funny enough on YouTube that you were like, or you just knew him through other people's concept of what Eugene Merman was?
Well, I was definitely, as I'm sure a lot of people who enjoy this show and people who come on the show can relate to, I was somebody who I was like, I know what's really funny. I know comedy. Yes.
Of course.
So I think there was some air of that. I'm trying to think maybe I had seen some Delocated or something like that.
I was
definitely aware of him other than just, oh, he's the guy on YouTube I saw in middle school or whatever.
Yeah.
The first time I saw him live though, was I was going to a music festival with my brother and a friend in Jersey City, New Jersey, a short-lived music festival called All Points West.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to see Radiohead and whoever else, but we were also very excited for the comedy tent where we saw Eugene Merman and Tim and Eric at the time.
Wow, okay.
And yeah, which, you know, to be whatever, a football field away from, I don't know, Kings of Leon or whatever, and seeing those acts was a very interesting mix. And the day that Eugene Merman was performing, my dad came with us for whatever reason.
Okay.
And as Eugene often does, he does like what I would call some like light prop comedy, maybe. Maybe not a super generous way of describing it, but you know, I'm a fan, no judgment.
Sure.
But he did a bit where he had written super personalized greeting cards, and it wasn't, he didn't want greeting cards to be vague, banal generalities anymore. He wanted to write greeting cards specifically to people he knew in the hopes that others would relate to them. So he wrote something about how he was thankful his mother potty trained him, and it got relatively graphic and scatological for him, to my recollection. And he came into the audience with all the cards at the end of the bit and was giving them out, and he handed this one to my father, who was probably twice the age of everybody else in the audience or something like that. And my dad was absolutely delighted, though. Like, that is exactly the type of thing that he, that is where he and I overlap in terms of comedy. I'm like, wow, oh, this is an alternative, weird, but he's sort of playing with prop comedy or whatever. And then my dad's like, haha, pee-pee jokes, you know, whatever. Yeah.
I love that he's that experimental, by the way, though. That there's, there doesn't seem to be anything quite that, that Eugene Merman wouldn't try to make funny, in terms of like, if you're not above, you shouldn't be above prop comedy, but it, again, it is a take on it, which I find fun.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when he, when it, he's like, trying to think, yeah, I'm pretty sure in this hour he does something about the art in his local Whole Foods, and I think he like painted something specifically in the hopes of getting it up in his local, his Whole Foods. And you know, it's things that he does, absurd sort of like takes on, you know, what would conventionally be called prop comedy, which I think I love. If a novelty record is done well, I find it hilarious. If prop comedy, you know, if there's perspective and care taken with it, I don't see why anything can't be funny, you know?
Yeah.
Why draw lines in the sand?
You know, let's talk a little bit about your own comedy then, because tell people a little bit about who you are, what you do, which I should have had you do at the very beginning. But just tell people a little bit about yourself.
Sure, yeah. My reputation does not precede me, decidedly so. No, yeah, I am based in New York, and I have done sketch shows, and I've done a little bit of improv and things like that, things that everybody who's trying to do comedy does. But I found a lot of those opportunities to be sort of limiting personally. So I now channel all of my, let's say, Merman-esque, absurd, navel gazing bits, and I make independent, whatever, DIY records that I put on, and when I say records, I mean digital, whatever. I put them on bandcamp.com. And I, you know, I have a quote unquote comedy album that is silent. I have an album that is 1 minute long, but is 10 sketches, bits, whatever, you know, and I, various things like that, things that novelty pieces that in my apartment late at night, I'm like, oh, that would be so funny if that existed. And then I spend months realizing them in the dumbest possible way. And then to resounding indifference from my peers, I will try to get my comedy friends interested in these things. And they're like, oh yeah, that's pretty funny, but let's do the fourth draft of this sketch or whatever.
Yeah, I wonder how that feels. Yeah, I know. Man after my own heart. I will say, yeah, normally if people invite themselves onto the podcast, I have the option of just acting like I never got the email. You know, I chose not to exercise that option, if only because I think the first thing I saw was your sold out at Madison Square Garden album. Yes. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to burn it. But I will say, go to his Bandcamp, and if you know what, if you've got the money, buy it first, and don't listen to it. I listened because, you know, I'm not as rich as you might be, but you know what, if you want to support an artist, do it. I like your approach. I'm sure Bandcamp is a nice, it's like, so I go back far enough that when I was doing comedy albums, it was on an entirely defunct website now, which is mp3.com. That was how you could get started. You could get your own CDs, and you know, just like you can get through wherever the fuck. Can you do CDs through Bandcamp at all? Do they have a physical I don't even know. I don't use it.
You can sell any format you want through mm-hmm. them, but mm-hmm. I don't believe they have the capability of printing, pressing, right. whatever things for you.
You can like tie it in with a CD baby or whatever the fuck that you've got. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, so this was a website where you literally uploaded your MP3s and they were mm-hmm. made to order. And if somebody ordered them, you got a very shitty quality CD. But it was the most exciting thing on the planet. And I like that you have the option now, though, to just put whatever that. Now, which of the albums is the silent album? Will you tell me which one that is?
Yeah, that one is called Selfie Stick.
Oh, there we are.
And I put it out as a sort of double record with Laughing Stock, which was the aforementioned 1 minute 10 sketch record.
Yeah.
10 6-second long tracks. Yeah. And I've done a couple other things. I've done things that are slightly more conventional. I mm-hmm. did like an extended character piece. I did something that is a straight ahead sketch album. And like, I love all of it equally. But the thing that I find most fun to do on there is to like my most sort of like obscure, weird, self-referential ideas that I could never get a friend to pursue with me. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, it's what was the name of the site you just mentioned, Jason? I'm sorry.
The original one, yeah. MP3.com. MP3.com. Okay. It is nothing now, basically. Mm. Yes.
But you know, the part of the reason that I started doing the Bandcamp stuff is I bemoaned the lack of resources that people had in doing things like that. So I think that's really awesome that existed, because if there is a service similar to that today, I am unaware of it. I've had friends in, I have more friends that do music mm-hmm. than do comedy, probably,
sure.
which was part of the reason I went to Bandcamp in the first place. But these like whatever, you're a drummer in a garage rock band in Brooklyn and you have 10 people that you can rely on to come to your shows. But those people are able to get a little bit of money and a little bit of notice on Bandcamp.com. And there's nothing really similar to that I know of for comedy.
Right.
I think any platform to support an independent weirdo artist like that is something that should be celebrated.
I agree. You know, I found there was a period of time, and I'm actually trying to pull it up now. They've changed their name. But at some point, Amazon did something similar. It's on the shitty side in terms of there are just a few format things that really bugged me. If you want to feel like it's your own, it doesn't have branding, but it has like little barcodes on it. I don't know if it's that way anymore, but I am seeing that they've changed their name to Amazon Media On Demand. So it is that is a possibility. And so, you know, and it doesn't cost you shit. You just, although normally I think with those kinds of systems, as usual, you have to order a proof yourself. So they at least make a little bit of money off of you. You get it, proof it, make sure it's good to go. And then they can offer it for sale on Amazon, which I had done at one point, but it looks like my account doesn't exist anymore. So that's good to know today. Hey, you discover new things all the time. But yeah, so that is an option. Yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things where I feel like I was extra motivated to make more stuff. Once MP3.com existed, I was like, oh shit,
yeah,
we can do this. I don't know. Like, we were also trying to do, you know, early digital video. This is in 2001, so we're talking the smallest possible video. I don't know. Making your own stuff, even though, you know, we were talking earlier about how you're saying, you know, if you're going to get your deal with Sub Pop, you're going to get your deal with Sub Pop after you're established like a Eugene Merman is in 2015. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel weird about making your own stuff that's this challenging and weird and experimental? Or do you think this is the time to get it out? Like, I don't need to wait till I'm famous. I can just do it now and I can express it as it comes to me.
Yeah, I would like to think that the weird stuff, if at any point anything ever comes of me writing and doing comedy, I would hope that the people who hypothetically would care care as much about silence that I uploaded to the internet on purpose as they would care about anything else that would actually generate money and some type of support conventionally for me. I would hope so. I mean, excuse me, I'm sorry.
You're fine.
I'm getting all choked up. I'm sorry, I had a thought and I lost it.
Hey, you're just like me. Oh my goodness. I oh my God, I'm now looking in to see how easy it is to buy vinyl blanks just so that you could release Selfie Stick with no tracks on it as a vinyl record.
Something that absolutely blew my mind listening to your show, Jason, was when you had Greg Turkington on and he talked about doing small presses of his own things and leaving them in thrift stores.
Right. I forgot he did that. Yeah.
Yeah. Which would, I cannot even imagine what a person would do picking up like a Neil Hamburger album by accident and paying no money for it. You know, I can only imagine.
It's the same experience. I think we talked about his book, Enjoy the Experience. I feel like it's him trying to enact the experience he gets when he picks up, you know, one of those rare, fucked up, self-produced, some of them are great, but, you know, weird, fucked up records. And the idea of, you know, for a moment, or at least if you don't have Google or you don't bother to Google, you think this is a real dude. You think this is a dude who did this with no self-awareness. And that's a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
Like, and it's a thing where you don't have to feel fooled. You weren't fucked with. You were just momentarily just sucked into a piece of art. And I don't know. I thought that was really beautiful. It's the most like, it is equally sincere and ironic. It's not this like super bitter Gen X thing that he's doing. I think it's genuinely fun and kind of beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. He is also someone who was, I don't want to get too far. Do podcasts do tangents, Jason?
I don't think so, but you know what? We're breaking new ground today. So please hit me with it.
Yeah, absolutely. But Greg Turkington specifically was somebody who was also super formative for me at a young age because, when I was like probably 14, I think I went to go see Tenacious D at Madison Square Garden,
which is
an insane sentence on its own. They were at the peak of their popularity because I think the movie was about to come out.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
So the movie had not yet fallen on its face, even though I think it's a fun, funny movie. Yeah. I enjoy them. But they're friends with Greg, and he often appears in their stuff. I think he like was on the HBO show that they did way back in the day.
Okay, yeah, right.
And he opened for them at Madison Square Garden as Neil Hamburger. And I was like 14 there to see Jack Black sing and dance and go shibba dabba booba dabba, whatever, you know, what Jack Black does. And Neil Hamburger came out, you know, the rumpled tuxedo, the comb over. He had multiple solo cups of whatever under his arm, and he came out and he bowed and spilled it all over the stage, which you can see, of course, on the Jumbotron at Madison Square Garden. And I was thrilled at the age of 14. I was so into it. And the crowd that was like filing in whatever 45 minutes before Tenacious D was going to take the stage, he was incredibly divisive, which I don't think would surprise you if you're familiar with the act, but he got the biggest response that I think that person he could have possibly gotten in that scenario. Like a half empty arena where a lot of people don't get it and don't realize, you know, what the bit is, whatever. He cheers and jeers with like equal vigor from the audience. And that absolutely blew my mind.
To be the kind of person for whom that is pure rocket fuel, I can't relate to, but I can tell you, he doesn't come across as that guy in person, but you can see it on stage. He couldn't keep going unless that was just like, just fueling him like a supervillain, just, you know, going off of screams. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I say that as somebody who in the audience loves and appreciates and connects with performers who are willing to go out on a limb like that. But in the rare occasion that I perform myself, I could never do something like that. I could never bear to be that confrontational and that transgressive in person, which is yet another reason I love Bandcamp.com, because I can for no money pursue my most stupid time-wasting ideas and then just throw it out into the void. I could never do a show of silence or something, but I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna make an album of silence, whatever, you know. Yes, so I'm a coward is my point.
Yeah, no, that's I'm the same. My best friend and I have been doing comedy together for nigh on 30 years at this point, since we were very tiny. Like, we've been making and recording sketch comedy. We've never performed live as that group. We've only made records, and I get it. It is what I've performed live on my own, but not together. Like, the thing I love the most, my sketch comedy, weirdly, is only lives on albums. Only.
I think that's really pure. in its way. I think that's amazing.
I mean, you should listen to them first before you make that statement. However, you are right. In general, the idea of it, I will agree with you. It is not a bad thing artistically.
Yeah. The way I first came across your show, Jason, is mm-hmm. I was so, like I said, my friends who do comedy were not super invested in me pursuing these projects on my own, which, you know, is everybody's right. Mm-hmm. Whatever. But I was like, what comedy is there on Bandcamp? Because I had sort of come to Bandcamp through, like I said, my musician friends. Mm-hmm. And I do remember seeing your label had a fair amount of things on there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You're right. We are up there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I to be honest, I'm sorry. I can't. This was a little while ago. I'm sorry. I don't remember if your records specifically were on there, but I do remember seeing, being like, oh, this is a comedy, an independent comedy label that mm-hmm. puts things on there, which I found very exciting.
You know what? I don't think ours are. I think it's only maybe right now the Paul Dooley record might be the only thing that we put up there. Okay. And again, this is one of these things where we're mid-discussion. I'm like, I really need to get my shit together uh-huh. on my own stuff. Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. You just
cash those checks. You don't even look where they're coming
from.
Yeah,
exactly. Boy, oh boy. I'm just fucking rolling in it over here, paying LA rent to sit here in LA and do nothing. Mm-hmm. So good. Can't go out. Can't do a goddamn thing. Don't know if you can relate. Yeah, this is it's a fun time. It's a fun mm-hmm. time. Do you, okay. Let's see then. Do you have, I don't want you to burn any ideas, but you don't have to be specific. Do you have ideas sitting there, or are they much more of a, it comes to me, I work on that one thing at a time, or do you get about 1,000 ideas flooding in and you're like, maybe I'll get to it at some point?
Oh gosh. I wish I was that person. The latter. Mm-hmm. No. I am, I'm much more like I'm the guy who makes the artisanal chair, the three artisanal chairs for Eugene Merman, and that's my life's work or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I'm very happy. I think I've put one short thing on Bandcamp per calendar year since I started doing it 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
And I'm happy with that output, whatever, for now. They're very short. Mm-hmm. And almost all of them are for sale for $1 at SpencerSapienza.bandcamp.com. Mm-hmm. But no, you know, I will have like a lot of bad half ideas, as I'm sure any comedian person can relate to.
Sure.
But the ones that I find worth pursuing are few and far between. I have a couple things. The big thing that I've always wanted to tackle that I keep kicking down the whatever the road, whatever that phrase is, you know, mm-hmm. The thing that I keep putting off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I say this as someone who was forced to move back in with my parents in suburban New Jersey due to the pandemic.
Sure.
I want to do a concept album about the history of the state of New Jersey. And that's something that I have worked on and off on for years. Mm-hmm. And when I say on and off, I mean, I will maybe pull up the Google Doc spreadsheet of it like a couple days a year. But mm-hmm. I have dozens of bad bit ideas for it, and I try to get other people to get excited about it with me, and shockingly it doesn't work usually, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. you know, who knows, maybe 2021 you could see that if you refresh SpencerSapienza.bandcamp.com. We'll see.
You know, there are worse things than doing, you know, the one a year. I respect mm-hmm. it. You've got your hour. It changes every time. One of them is a silent hour. I do. It's just worth looking. Again, this is the kind of thing. It's rare that a website, that I can go to a website or a web page and have it feel like a little piece of art. And Bandcamp is a good place to do that. But mm-hmm. I like that I'm just looking at your covers now. Is this you entire? Okay, will you please explain your duets album to people? I know we're here to talk about Eugene Merman, but just explain it right to people.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. I'm a great salesman. No, duets was actually an idea I had a very long time ago, mm-hmm. and was then written, recorded, whatever, produced entirely during the pandemic, me in my underwear alone in my Brooklyn apartment at the time, because mm-hmm. my roommate had left me alone for the pandemic, which was fair and mm-hmm. Whatever. But it's me quote unquote duetting with classic sketch comedy pieces. So I guessed on the Dead Parrot sketch with my buddies in Monty Python. Mm-hmm. I appear on a Adam Sandler record because those were also very formative for me at a young age. And then I did something. My buddy Jordan Peele, who he's pivoted from comedy to horror now, but but yeah, I got him to come out of comedy retirement to have me edit myself into a YouTube rip of one of his sketches. The cover is myself in the place of Adam Sandler on his first four comedy albums, which, like I said, were big for me. I know you've talked about them extensively on this show, so I won't get into those records, but yeah.
Probably best only because it's, you know, you talk about it enough, you entirely you have nothing left to say, and I would contribute very little. And I feel like I'm contributing nothing today because all I'm doing is thinking of how I can somehow make one of your records turn into a vinyl record now. That's all my brain can do. I can't even do it for myself. Why am I? See, this is my mental problem. I'm you know, I care too much about other people's ideas. I care too much. That's my weakness. Is this what you were asking in our job interview? I care too much. Do I have the job? That's the question.
You are hired, Jason.
Oh, thank you so much. Have you? So you've seen Eugene live a few times. Have you met the man? Have you been fortunate enough to meet the man?
Other than standing very close to him when he handed my father a novelty greeting card, no, I have not. I mean, this is the only podcast I'll ever do, so I'll just use all my stories. I used to work as a personal assistant to a very famous New York-based comedian who I will refrain from using their name on mic. He was not a great boss, whatever. I worked there for not an extensive amount of time, but he was dropping in on one of Eugene's shows. And I went with him to the show, which had an amazing, it may have been the last ever show at the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival, I don't remember the schedule. It was one of the last ones so Eugene used to do, again, as a somewhat serious but mostly ridiculous conceptual bit, he had a festival for many years in Brooklyn called the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival that he did, you know, he did put a lot of work into organizing it. And it was not just him. There were many, many comedians who would perform at like good, nice, reputable venues across Brooklyn and possibly Manhattan. I don't remember, but whatever. And it was like a cool, great thing for New York. Their stand-up, improv, podcast recording, whatever, all the usual suspects. But the last time he was doing it, which was 3, maybe 4 years ago, I happened to be working for this comedian who shall remain nameless, and he was doing a drop-in set at it was at the Bell House or Union Hall, I can't remember, somewhere in Brooklyn, and it had an amazing lineup, and I was lucky enough to get to ride on my boss's coattails and get in for free and see. I maybe shook hands with one or two people, but there's no chance, like John Glazer would have no idea who I was, even though I did briefly say hello to him or whatever. That job, the moral of that story was, I don't want to ever be a comedian that can fill arenas. Not that I would ever have that opportunity, probably, but I saw that lifestyle was not something I wanted for myself.
Yeah, isn't that always interesting? I mean, I came out here, I am a filmmaker, but there are parts of it that you think you want until you are knee deep in it, or as close as you can be to knee deep in it, see how it affects people, sort of realize that maybe they're not aware of how they're being affected. It's a nice thing to be just separate enough from those things to be like, okay, I can pick pieces of what I'd actually like in my life. You know, I think, you know,
absolutely. I totally agree. I have been fortunate enough to have just enough entry and just above entry level jobs in film, comedy, whatever, to realize that most of it is crock of shit. Yep. And it's not what I thought. I realized it's not what I actually wanted, which is a great thing to learn, I think. But I keep banging my head against the wall, keep trying to do it. I hope I end up my dream is to end up one day a lot more like someone like Eugene Merman rather than the various people I have actually worked for.
Sure. Sure. Tell me a bit more about this record. I only because of time commitments, I could only commit to whatever you figured was your, maybe, did you, the part you picked for me to listen to, would you consider it one of your favorite tracks, or what was your particular reasoning for picking the three options you gave me?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I when we decided on this, I knew I didn't want to do the stand up because, in my opinion, what is special about this box set is not the stand up hour, even though it's a good stand up hour. Yeah. I wanted to do one of the novelty records, and I think I picked two or three, you know, something that wasn't, there's a whole LP that is Eugene making crying noises, and I thought that may not be great conversation fodder.
Sure.
So I picked some of the ones that are slightly more stimulating, and I believe we settled on what is LP 6 in the box set, because it has like a great variety of things. The first side of LP 6 is Introduction to Spoken Russian, which we mentioned briefly before. Yeah. And then the second side is both ringtones and voicemail messages that Eugene records so generously in advance for us fans, so that people will no longer stop him on the street and say, hey, will you please record a voicemail message for me or whatever. And they start out all of these things. I think it starts out somewhat conventional. The Russian, it's hi, how are you? Nice to meet you. And the ringtones and voicemail messages, you know, it's him. He makes a ringtone noise with his mouth. And then he says, hey, you know, Sally can pick up the phone, whatever. And then, of course, they slowly degrade, advance, heighten into whatever horrible nonsense he felt like saying it with his studio time. And it's great. It's great. But, you know, I think this LP works so well because I think it is a perfect encapsulation of what the whole box is about. But he burns through the premises pretty quickly, which I think is also great because, you know, like I said, LP 5, 45 minutes of crying. And it is as advertised to anyone who hasn't heard. It is not, he doesn't pull a fast one on you and actually do a secret, another 45 minutes of stand-up after a minute of crying.
Right.
Yeah. LP 7, 195 orgasm sounds. Also very funny, but it is a full slab of vinyl of him. I'm pretty sure there's like, he's like imagining what Kevin Kline sounds like at Climax or something like that. You know, I can't, it's been a few weeks since, or months since I've listened to the whole thing, but you know, it's a box set that you pull out every once in a while and you go, I'm so glad I have this, but this is not, it's not in regular rotation. But
right.
When the mood strikes you, there's nothing quite like it.
It's one of those things where in my head, I'm like, this would be a really funny thing to actually turn into a party album, until I realize 4 minutes in, everybody's like, yeah, I get it. This is very funny. You can't, I don't know if you can experience a novelty set like this in any other way than it's just you and Eugene Merman. Like, you just have to listen to it alone. Right? Do you have, okay, we've talked a bit about how you've got some people who maybe are not as on board with some of your weirder album ideas, but have you made friends over comedy?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, I used to do typical good, whatever, sketch and improv shows in New York. And I, even though I'm not still doing those things, you know, unrelated to the pandemic, I haven't really been doing those things recently. I still talk to those people all the time. And it's great. You know, It like with anything, you know, I said I have those friends who do music, and it's great to have people that you can just like share the inside jokes with. You know, I want to reference specific stupid things about Lou Reed's career or whatever. And by that same token, so many of those people would have no idea what I'm talking about when I say, hey, do you want to listen to 7 LPs of Eugene Merman making mouth noises? But then other than I've gotten to do fun shows with those comedy people, it's always a joy to have friends that do those things, because we can then talk obsessively about the comedy that we love and hate.
Yeah. Is this something that only became part of your life as you became a comedy person, or as a kid, did you also have stuff you shared with It doesn't have to be albums because you may not have had any albums growing up, which I didn't ask you yet.
No, yeah, I didn't have vinyl until it became hip. But I had comedy CDs growing up. Absolutely. I was like 9 years old running around quoting Mel Brooks movies. And, you know, by that token, not extremely popular.
Sure.
Yeah. So
good parents if they're letting you watch Mel Brooks, as far as I'm
concerned. Absolutely. I had to fight tooth and nail to see Blazing Saddles, but for some, you know, or I think for obvious reasons, but I was allowed to see all the other ones.
My parents wouldn't let me watch Blazing Saddles until I was like 15 or 16. And I think for good reason.
Yeah. Now I'm really curious because I kind of wonder, I tried to show my most recent ex Spaceballs and as a 20 something, she was not super into it. And I kind of didn't blame her, even though I still have so much love for that movie specifically and Mel Brooks more broadly. I'm curious, at the age of 15, 16, did Blazing Saddles like go over with you totally well?
It changed my life. It blew my mind.
Okay.
Blew my mind. Now, Spaceballs is a different situation because I think I probably did discover that at 6 or 7 or 8, and I was a huge Star Wars nerd. And it was the first time where every reference made sense to me, so I locked in on it. Although weirdly now I'm like, I don't have that much nostalgia for it. I like it. And I rediscovered my nostalgia for it a little bit when we did it on stage a few years ago here, and I was Dark Helmet, and fucking phenomenal. But yeah, Blazing Saddles absolutely became my favorite movie. And maybe it's partially because they held back. Maybe it's, there are complicated reasons for why, but I still think it is a beautiful piece of satire that a lot of people misunderstand, and it drives me insane when people don't get it.
No, totally. I think the rote, dumb, in my opinion, conversation about they couldn't make Blazing Saddles today. You know, if you're saying that, I kind of think you're already missing the point.
I
don't know. I guess those like super broad, sketch inspired films or whatever, you know, I love them so much. I really like the Zucker brothers also.
Sure.
Zucker, Abram Zucker, whatever. I grew up and adore Mel Brooks, but I wonder morbidly if I had seen them later than when I did, would I still like them? Is it that thing? Yeah. Kentucky Fried Movie absolutely blew me away when I was 12. And then I tried again. I watched it years later. I watched it in college and I was like, oh gosh, I was like tugging on my collar a little bit. Yeah.
But, I mean, I mean, it's obviously to the person and to the movie, what's going to age and well and what isn't. But I don't know. It honestly, the tugging at the collar says something more about you in a good way. I think, you know, you're allowed to grow out of not liking stuff or liking stuff. You know, But yeah, I also have the same curiosity. I'm like, do I just like this because I was a kid when I saw it? I might like Wayne's World. I love. I've seen that movie more than anything in my whole life. I don't know if it's that good, but I love it. I love it. I don't think I'll stop loving it.
I totally relate to that.
You know,
in the pandemic, sort of circling back to something we were talking about earlier. In the pandemic, because we all have a fair amount of free time now, I made the choice of watching every single Adam Sandler movie and just seeing how that would go. And another person who I loved as a child. And I've sort of gone up and down with him because I think my big realization at the end of watching 40 something odd films of his, he is a very talented, committed actor when he wants to be. And I would also say comedian. And he deliberately chooses not to be for the most part. But he's kind of amazing to watch because you see the spirit when he's locked in and when the movies are good, if you like Adam Sandler, I can still relate to what I loved about Happy Gilmore or The Waterboy when I was 8 or 9, whatever.
Sure.
But then I also have that degree of separation where I'm like, I am a 28-year-old man and this person is being paid millions of dollars to adopt a silly voice and scream at people occasionally or whatever, you know. So Mel Brooks and Adam Sandler, not the same by any means, but it is great to have those things and appreciate them years and years later, understand their value, but maybe not have that be your entire frame of reference for like what comedy is or what art is or whatever.
Big time. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're cucks for thinking that. You're supposed to always think the same stuff that you always thought of. It was funny. You're never supposed to change because then you're a wimp. I mean, this is what I understand of masculinity. I could be wrong. This is what I'm told is the case. So why don't you tell folks about the Eugene Merman album? You know what? This is going to be the best. This is going to be the hardest sell. I want you to try and convince people they need to purchase this, not just listen to it. But I always tell you, give them in 2 seconds why they should listen to it, two sentences. But then I also want you to give me a third sentence, roughly three sentences, about why to actually physically put your money down and purchase this.
Okay. If you are a person who listens to the Comedy on Vinyl podcast and you do not respect and love the idea of a honestly gorgeous 7 LP box set, including a good hour of stand-up, and then also including 6 LPs of novelty pseudo party record comedy, you don't deserve to listen to the Comedy on Vinyl podcast.
That's fair.
Lovely box set, very good comedy.
So thick. It's a thick fucking box. Although it's weirdly, I have the Bob's Burgers one here, and that's thicker than that for some reason. They've really tightened them up in that package, haven't they? That is a very tight little... I guess the Bob's Burgers one comes with a bunch of extra shit, though. But that could be why it's so much... Yeah, it's so nice, nice matte green. Ooh, what is that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, a nice little cherry on top. Liner notes by Daniel Kitson. A little pamphlet of genius comedy included in your box set of genius comedy.
So good.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah,
I love it. And get the robe. If you guys can afford it, get the robe. Why would
get
you not?
Get the robe. Get the robe. Track down the carpenters who made the chair and get them to make you a reproduction.
Right? There you go.
If you can't purchase the one yourself.
Now, if he only sold two. Now, again, I'd like to have him on the show. I'd like to find out, did you buy two chairs at a Goodwill? And like that's my other thought is like, he might have just done that. He might have just, I want to know the specs on this because that's... Yeah, it's been one of my favorite pieces of art, and I've long been waiting to actually have a reason or excuse to listen to any part of it. Now I'm going to have to listen to the rest of it. You've now pushed it into my brain because I feel guilty, and this you know, this was very good and a lot of fun to listen to. Spencer, this has been a delight. Will you tell people this is not going to come out for a really long time, but would you mind still telling people where they can find you, your stuff, and if there's anything coming up that is urgent, let them know, and I'll figure out a way to get that out there too.
I did this will date the episode. I did the New York Times quiz, how long until you get the vaccine today? So based on that, I will say, Jason, absolutely nothing is urgent in my life. I am Spencer Sapienza at Spencer Sapienza on Twitter, spencersapienza.bandcamp.com. I'd say that's most of where you can find my quote unquote comedy. I occasionally write humorous things on the internet in the forms of poetry and short fiction. I occasionally make a YouTube video or a Vimeo video if YouTube pulls the video for some reason. You can find all that under my name. And if you like at all what is going on here with Eugene Merman's I'm Sorry, You're Welcome, A Singular Experience for the Modern Listener, it is subtitled. If you like this at all, I would really genuinely hope you would find something to appreciate in my not nearly as well-produced comedy that I make on Bandcamp. And Jason, thank you so much.
Are you kidding? This was a lot of fun. You're welcome back anytime, of course. And what am I going to tell people? There's nothing of any timely use. But you know what? Since you mentioned it, go to CelerySoundRecords.com. That is my very tiny little record label where you can check out also some very experimental, Fire Sign inspired, but experimental, our only vinyl, which is... it's a long story how that even happened, but it's called A Gift You Didn't Ask For from Friends You Never Had, and it's very good, and they play with the format hard. They do a lot of interesting shit. And then, I don't know, go to stolendress.com. That's where my other podcasts are. Thank you guys for listening, and as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!